Hello, and welcome to Eyes on Success, a weekly program of information on the ever-changing world of accessibility. Now here are the hosts of this program, Nancy Goodman-Torpey and Peter Torpey.
Hello, I'm Nancy.
And I'm Pete. On this week's show, we'll be talking about competitive tandem bicycle racing.
We'll speak with Matt King, who you may remember from last week when he spoke about accessibility of Facebook products, about his experiences. And as a tandem bicycle racer, he set a world speed record and participated in 3 consecutive Paralympic Games. He describes these experiences, including what it feels like to be riding a bicycle over 45 miles an hour around sharp turns banked at over 45 degrees. But first, for our tip of the week. This week's tip is staying fit is good for your body and your soul, although it may not be necessary to prepare for the Paralympics to achieve those benefits. And you can use our handy search tool to find many other episodes of Eyes on Success that we've done talking about various types of exercise or sports.
Just put in the words exercise, sports, and you'll come up with a list of all of those shows, along with summaries to the shows and links to the audio and show notes for each episode. And you can use that search feature for many other topics also.
And just to give you some examples of some of the types of sports that we've covered, we talked about running, skiing, sailing, golfing, baseball, and cricket to cover fans from around the world, and even some unexpected sports for blind people, such as ice hockey, martial arts, hiking alone in the forest, etc.
Support for Eyes on Success is provided by
Mystic Access, providing assistive technology audio tutorials and trainings designed to empower and motivate. Products are created by the blind for the blind. More information available at mysticaccess.com, where the magic is in learning.
And by
eSight, maker of digital eyewear designed to help improve vision for people with low vision and legal blindness. The technology can be used to read, see faces, and explore the world. More information is available at eSightEyewear.com. Let's start by reintroducing Matt King from last week.
So, Matt, we talked to you last week about your work at Facebook and accessibility and your role there, but maybe you can refresh our listeners a bit about what you do at Facebook and then tell us a little bit about your interest outside Facebook that we're going to focus on in the rest of this show.
Sure. I started on the Facebook engineering team as an accessibility specialist within actually accessibility engineering last June. I came to Facebook from IBM. I was there for 25 years and spent the last 17 of those working on accessibility for the IBM workplace and IBM web. I was the IBM senior technical lead for accessibility for IBM's chief information officer there for a lot of years. And over the course of my years at IBM, one of the other things that I had the privilege of doing early in my career was to compete on 3 Paralympic teams. I went to Atlanta in 1996, to Sydney in the year 2000, and to Athens in 2004, racing as part of the U.S. national cycling team.
And that's what we'll be speaking about mostly in today's show.
You are listening to Eyes on Success. Success, 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 success.
This week's focus topic is Matt's experiences bicycling, including training for and participating in the Paralympic Games.
So as we discussed in last week's show, you did have some vision when you were younger, although you lost most of your vision later in life. Did you start some of these sports and cycling activities when you did have more vision?
I did to some extent. So I was never able to see well enough to race a bicycle or a motorcycle, which is what I really wanted to race when I was younger, and that was always something that was sort of a just an unfulfilled dream that I had, and I really didn't have any idea how to go about achieving it at that time in my life. The thought of tandem bikes never even crossed my mind when I was younger. I never saw them at any of the bike races that I went to or anything like that. But I did ride my bike everywhere. And of course, since I couldn't get a driver's license, that really meant everywhere. I commuted to my job. I was an organist at our church, and I rode down there, you know, every day to practice and on the weekends to actually play for the services. And I delivered newspapers on the bicycle for years. And actually, I think that was probably the best sprint training that I ever had, because you'd load up the front of the bicycle with a box that had over 100 newspapers in it. And then I would sprint from mailbox to mailbox, rolling up the papers, throwing them in the tube that was mounted on the side of the mailbox, and trying not to stop ever. You know, I'd always try to get it in the tube. And then speed as fast as I could to the next mailbox, because I timed myself and I always wanted to see exactly how fast I could get the paper route done. I remember one time I delivered 78 papers in 17 minutes once, and I was pretty proud of it.
Wow.
You had sort of a competitive instinct then from when you were pretty young.
Yeah, you could say that.
You know, I had some limited vision when I was younger, and I used to ride my bike around the neighborhood, and I can't tell you how many garbage cans I crashed into because they were gray and the street was gray.
Yeah, I know exactly what you're talking about. I particularly had difficulty with shadows, and I had some pretty unfortunate mishaps within the shadows of trees or buildings and so forth.
But you somehow survived when you were young and then went on to do some more serious biking. When did you first find out that people could ride on tandems and compete in races that way?
I was a junior in college, and at that point in time, I remember seeing on the cover of Bicycling magazine, so I could still see a little bit. My brother had shared this with me, and I was still using, I think it was called a VTech, a closed circuit TV system at the time.
I remember those. I had one of those.
Yeah, I had the 19-inch display. By the time I wasn't using it anymore, or that I stopped using it, I had to fill the entire screen with like three letters. I couldn't even do a whole word on there. It was just, it got to be pretty impractical.
Yeah, I went through that transition also.
For me, that was right around 1986 when I first started using the screen reader. Anyway, I was looking at Bicycling magazine, this whole issue dedicated to tandems, and I just got this dream right away. I wanted to own a tandem, and I saved up all the money I could, and when I was a junior in college, I got my first tandem, and it wasn't really a racing tandem. I just tried to make it into a racing tandem.
Once you got the bike, did you have a regular riding partner?
I would get anybody I could to ride the front of that thing, and some people were scared to death, and others really took to it. And I spent a lot of time riding around the roads of northern Indiana and southern Michigan during my college years. I was at the University of Notre Dame, and I really took to it right away.
And how did you move on from doing social and informal rides with your buddies to more competitive racing later on?
It wasn't until 1994 when I read a brief advertisement in the Braille Forum, and the United States Association of Blind Athletes ran an ad for one of their training camps at the Olympic Training Center. And it caught my ear right away. I called the coach. At that time, it was Peter Paulding. And I gave him a call right away. And I just started drilling him with questions. And he says, well, I think you might be a really good candidate for this camp. So why don't you come on out? And so the following May of 1995, I went for my first time to the Olympic Training Center. And yeah, I was in love right away. I did a stage race that following June in Eugene, Oregon, and just I had a blast.
Now, how long was the training camp?
I think it was about a week or 5 days or something like that. And it was extremely instructive. And probably the most important thing that it did, though, is it connected me with other people who are interested in racing, and especially people who are interested in piloting in races. And that was the real ticket that I need in order to get started.
Is that where you teamed up with your captain for the competitions?
No, actually, what happened is I went to this race in Eugene, Oregon, and was racing in what was called the Mixed B category. It was for pilots and stokers who were called Cat 3 or Cat 4 racers. So when you license yourself with USA Cycling, which is the national governing body for the sport of cycling in the United States, you get a license to race, and takes care of things like insurance and so forth. And you're categorized, and it starts with Cat 5 for men and Cat 4 for women. And you can work your way up to Cat 1, and then beyond that is pro. So I was racing in essentially the beginner's category. And you have to say it's pretty dicey because, of course, the people who are driving these tandems, and you're in a pack of about 30 tandems, and, you know, nobody is super experienced. so it was fun. There were a few crashes. That was always sort of a freaky sound to hear. You know, it definitely got the adrenaline going. The greatest benefit of that race was that there was somebody racing in the mixed A category. His name was Spencer Yates, and he was a pro on the mountain bike circuit at that time and was a Cat 2 on the road and just a really strong rider. And he saw me, and at the end of the race, he's like, "How would you like to go for a ride together tomorrow?" And so we went for a ride, and we just really connected. And he says, "You want to race nationals at the end of the month?" I'm like, "You bet." And so we went to nationals and unseated the previous champion. And I was on top of the world.
Wow. Now, were you two living in the same town? How did you manage to do all the practices that you needed to do?
Well, Spencer was from upstate New York originally, but I think at the time he was living in Arizona, but was pretty much a bike bum. He had a Subaru Legacy that had essentially everything he owned in it and a bunch of bikes on top of the car. So we had a couple of my bikes on top of the car. And yeah, we kind of became bike bums. I used up all my vacation, and then IBM was at that time beginning to experiment with people working remotely. And I got permission to start working remotely. And then in January of 1996, I got permission from my boss to work half time. And so I was essentially working 20 hours a week tops, and I got some extra weeks off for racing. And so I essentially became a full-time cyclist, and my IBM salary largely supported Spencer and I as we got ready to go to the Paralympics.
Were you living in New York at the time?
Yes, I was. My home base was New York, but to facilitate training, January 20th of 1996, I took off for Tucson, Arizona, mid-May. We actually started the trek towards Trexlertown, Pennsylvania, but we did a lot of racing along the way. Trexlertown, Pennsylvania, just where our coach lived, and is where the velodrome that we were going to do most of our training on was, because we were racing not just on the road, but also on the velodrome.
For our listeners who may not be familiar with it, can you describe what a velodrome is?
I would love to, because the first time that I was on a velodrome, I had no idea what I was getting into. I couldn't see it, and other people had to describe it to me, and what we initially did was just walk around it, and that was the velodrome in Colorado Springs, Colorado, at the Olympic Training Center, the camp that I was talking about in 1995. A velodrome is a bike racing track that is banked, and is banked most steeply in the corners, of course, so that facilitates you being able to go through the turn at high speed. And In Colorado Springs, that track is 333.333 meters, is three laps for a 1 kilometer time trial, which is one of the two standard lengths of a track. Another standard length is 250 meters. There are a variety of tracks in the world, some as long as 400 and some as short as like 160. And the standard Olympic length is 250 meters. So it's shorter than a running track. Your laps are really fast. And on a 250 meter track, it's oval shaped. So there are two straightaways, and we call them four turns, even though it's like two turns at the end. Turns one and two is one end, and turns three and four is the other end. It's an oval, and the banking at the apex of the turns, like between turn one and two and between turn three and four, is usually between 42 and 48 degrees. That's pretty steep.
Wow, that's pretty steep.
If you can imagine, you know, a 45-degree angle, if you try to walk up a wooden track, you can't do it. Even if you try to, like, sit on it and crab walk up backwards, you'll just slide down. It's steep.
So it sounds like it's the shape of a small stadium, except where you're riding is in the bleachers.
Yeah, you could say like that. Pretty smooth bleachers, though.
Right. That has to be intimidating the first time, because if you're not going fast enough, you're not staying up on the ramp.
That's exactly what will happen if you don't go the minimum speed. And they make sure you know what the minimum speed is, which is a little bit higher for a tandem, too. The other thing that looks kind of strange to some people is when you're riding slowly, especially, the back wheel of the tandem will be a little bit lower on the track than the front wheel of the tandem is kind of interesting. But of course, as you get speed, then you start leaning into the turns. And to me, one of the most thrilling things, of course, is when we do a 200 meter time trial to get seated for sprints.
Can you describe what it was like doing the time trials?
The way that works is you do a few laps, sort of warm-up laps, slow at the very top of the track. We call that riding on the rail. And so you ride on the rail, and then in the very last lap, you dive down to the bottom to maximize your speed, and you want to do that last 200 meters as fast as you possibly can. And that dive in turns one and two and the backstretch, you know, down into what we call the pole lane or the bottom of the lane of the track is just a really thrilling acceleration. And then you're coming through after you're at full speed. You're coming through turns three and four headed for the straightaway. And on some of these velodromes, the banking is so steep and you're leaned over so far that you can just hear the ground next to you. You know, it's a really awesome feeling. And sometimes, depending on the surface of the track and what tires you're riding, I remember in particular the track in Atlanta had this surface that it just, the tires just sort of did this high whistly whine, and you could hear that change with your speed. And to me, it was just all really thrilling.
So give us an idea what kind of speeds we're talking about here.
Well, for a 200 meter sprint, you're talking in the neighborhood of 45 miles an hour when you're going two turns, three and four.
Without a seatbelt.
Yes.
That is screaming. So I take it weight is really a concern with these bikes and making them light enough for racing optimally. Do you have brakes on these bikes?
So a track bike doesn't have any brakes. It's interesting you ask that.
Do you ever stop?
We do have to stop, actually. So a track bike has what's called direct drive. So there is a chain that goes from the gear on the back wheel to the gear on the cranks. And that gear on the back, if the wheel is turning, that gear is turning. There's no freewheel action like a lot of people have on their road bike where you can sort of pedal backwards and it doesn't do anything. Or on a really old-fashioned like bike with a coaster brakes. Well, of course, they're still around. They're not that old-fashioned. But, you know, try to pedal backwards and it closes the brake shoes for you.
Right.
Well, on a track bike, if you pedal backwards, you're actually going backwards. And if you pedal forward, you're going forward. So the way that you slow down is to apply back pressure on the pedals. So that fixed gear system is part of what makes track bikes both lighter, stronger, as well as just really fast. Of course, you have to pick your gear ahead of time. There's no changing gears while you're out riding. So a track bike is about as simple as you can get when it comes to a bicycle.
And I take it you guys are mostly standing as you're racing to get the maximal power into the pedals.
No, actually, that depends on where you are in the race. So when you're accelerating quickly, you will typically stand. But when you're at top speed, you have to sit so you can spin as fast as possible, because it's impossible to spin at your top speed if you're standing. I don't know what my maximum cadence was out of the saddle, but you know, in the saddle, when you're doing that 45 mile an hour neighborhood type of speed, you're pedaling typically in excess of 150 revolutions per minute. So it's pretty fast.
Wow.
Most people, they ride a bike down the road, you know, they're pedaling right around, well, let's just say when I get on a bike with my daughter, you know, if we go above 60 RPM, she's starting to feel like we're pedaling too fast. So, and I think that's pretty typical. You know, most people pedal somewhere in that 50, 60, 70 is fast for them range. For a road racers typically race in the 80 to 100 RPM range. You know, depending on the conditions, you know, sometimes slower, sometimes considerably faster. But it's pretty rare for, you know, a road racer isn't going to pedal 150 RPMs. They're going to go ahead and shift their gears because they have more gears. But a track racer can't do that.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Did you do mostly sprint racing or long distance or a combination or what?
It varied through the years. I tried just about everything. In Atlanta, our focus was on the 4,000-meter pursuit, and that's considered to be an endurance race on the track because, you know, it's beyond what you can do in an all-out effort for, like, maximal effort, like in a 200-meter sprint where you there's no sense of pacing yourself. You're just full bore. But in a four-minute-plus distance, you really do have to pace yourself. In fact, how you pace yourself is an important part of the strategy. So that was a 4,000 meter. We were, Spencer and I had a really good ride in Atlanta. That's where we actually set a world record for the time on that particular track. And I think it was 4 minutes and 32.083 seconds for our 4,000 meter. Now, that record held for 4 years. And since then, it's been really crushed. I'm not sure what the current world record is, but I'm pretty sure that it's in the neighborhood of 4 minutes and 21 seconds or something like that.
Gee, that is a big difference.
Yeah. You know, bike technology, track technology, everything, you know, plus just how people train and everything. I mean, there's just, it's constantly advancing. It's pretty exciting stuff.
So you said you went to 3 separate Paralympic Games. Were they significantly different experiences for you?
Yeah, they were very different experiences, partly because of where they were. So in 1996, it was Atlanta, Georgia. In the year 2000 was Sydney, Australia. And the year 2004 was Athens, Greece. So, of course, each location, you experience a different culture and, you know, a different environment within the Olympic Village and different venues. But they were also different just because I did different kinds of races over the years, well, at least in 1996, I was focused on the 4,000 meter time trial and the road race. But in the years 2000 and 2004, I was focused on the 1,000 meter time trial and the match sprints.
Are you still involved in competitive biking, or do you just do this for fun now with family and friends?
Yeah, when I'm on my bike now, it's just casual. In fact, since I started at Facebook, I've been riding even less, so I got to fix that. But I would actually like to compete again someday in the Masters categories. I just enjoy being out there and riding and having fun, and competition is part of having fun for me. So I expect that I'll be back in some of the Masters races, mixing it up someday.
Well, that just sounds like too much fun. Now for this week's final item, how to learn more about tandem bicycling, including some options for acquiring your own first bike.
So if people are interested in competitive biking, where can they find out more?
Well, if you're blind and you're interested in competitive cycling and you're not yet competitive, then the best place to start is the U.S. Association of Blind Athletes. That's usaba.org. They also have a Facebook page, of course, and they still have training camps a couple times a year, and there's a lot of opportunities for people to learn what it takes to get involved. But even if you want to just learn more about recreational cycling, there are resources people at USABA can help. There are also some foundations out there that can help people get tandem bikes, you know, depending on where you live. And I think even the Rush Miller Foundation is one that people can look up where I'm not sure if Eric is still actively working on giving away bikes, but I think he is. So that might be an option if somebody is, you know, interested, but is definitely financially stretched and doesn't have any other way to pursue it.
And I understand you have a website where you write about some of these experiences. Can you tell people where to find that?
Well, I did write about a lot of my cycling experiences. I haven't been blogging lately. Now, if I write stuff, it's more about accessibility and assistive technologies and those types of things. But a lot about my own personal cycling experiences at www.thekinglink.com, thekinglink.com.
And as usual, you'll find links to all of that information in the show notes for this episode. And we also included a link to an article on the Vision Aware website that talks about bicycling for people with vision impairments. Just go to www.eyesonsuccess.net.
That's it for show number 1616. Next week, timed to be in coordination with this year's Boston Marathon, we will speak with a blind marathoner and his celebrity guide. We will speak with Eric Manser, a blind accessibility engineer from IBM, and Peter Sagal, host of NPR's Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, about their experiences running the 2014 Boston Marathon together. They talk about how they got together, the special trust required to run as partners, and what happens when things don't go quite as planned. If you have any questions regarding something you've heard about on the show, or you'd like to share an idea for a future show, send an email to hosts@eyesonsuccess.net or call us at 585-210-8094.
You've been listening to Eyes on Success, hosted and produced by Nancy Goodman-Torpey and Peter Torpey and distributed by WXXI Reach Out Radio. Browse the full archive of programs, find instructions for subscribing to the podcasts, and much more at www.eyesonsuccess.net. You can also find us on iTunes, follow us on Facebook and on audioboom.com, at Eyes on Success, or Twitter at @_EyesOnSuccess. We hope you will join us again next week for more information and updates on products for accessible living. Thanks for listening to Eyes on Success and have a nice day.